Welcome to the first episode of Law and Religion Down Under. My name is Jeremy Patrick, and I'm the chair of the Law, Religion, and Heritage Research Program team in the University of Southern Queensland School of Law and Justice. This bi-monthly podcast is all about the fascinating and complex interactions between the worlds of faith and law in Australia. And every episode will feature an interview with a different guest. My aim is to provide insight and perspectives from across the spectrum of religious and ideological beliefs. Today, I'm speaking with Toowoomba resident Ron Williams. Ron was a plaintiff in the two high court cases in 2012 and 2014 that challenged the constitutionality of Commonwealth funding for chaplains in Australian public schools. Although the High Court dispensed with an argument based on the religious test provision of Section 116 of the Constitution, it did find in his favor that the Commonwealth lacked legislative and executive power to fund the program. But although Ron won twice in the High Court, the National School Chaplaincy Program still continues today under a funding mechanism that channels money through grants to state governments. My goal for today's episode is to avoid getting into the technical legal arguments, as there's plenty of that in published decisions and law journal articles, and I'll place those in the show notes. Instead, I'd like to talk to Ron himself about what motivated the litigation, what it was like facing the daunting prospect of suing the Commonwealth, and how he feels about it now that some years have passed. Ron, thank you very much for coming on the podcast.
Pleasure to be here, Jeremy.
I'm very much looking forward to speaking with you about your experiences as the plaintiff in the two cases that bear your name in high court history now, Williams 1 and Williams 2. I guess, as is often the case, the best place to start is at the beginning. So what led to you getting interested and involved in knowing about school chaplaincy and deciding that it was something you needed to do something about?
Yeah. I'll be as brief as I can, because it's fairly complex how I ended up in the High Court. And even though I probably looked like some sort of Forrest Gump, wandered into the High Court in Canberra off the street.
Forrest Gump, you were successful with what you attempted. So,
yes, I didn't get the long beard at the end of them. Although it seemed like it was that long. Yeah, look, as I said, I'll be as brief as I can. But in 2001, we'd had two children who were only littlies, well away from school age. And my wife is a dual citizen, dual Australian, US citizen by parentage. Her parents were US citizens. And she had lived in the States various times before we were married. And for various reasons, we decided that we would emigrate to the US. This was in 2001, post 9/11, but it was at that stage. So we did this, and it was great living over there. We really enjoyed it. I don't have to tell you how great it is living in the US, Jeremy, and all of that. But for various reasons, with family at home, some things were going on that we really thought we had to come back to Australia, with saying that we could go back at any stage. And so we did this in 2002, late 2002, because I thought, well, that's okay. Our little bloke, our eldest then, we had another little girl while we were in the US.
Okay, yep.
So she's a dual citizen now. So. Anyway, so I thought, well, that won't be all so bad, because Andrea and I had both gone through the public school system here in Australia. And I thought, well, that's a nice secular education system. That'll be good for our eldest then when he becomes school age. So we came back to Australia, and as the time came for our eldest to start school, here in Toowoomba, that was all right. He started in preschool, wasn't prep at that stage. And then when he got to year one, the question of religious instruction came up. Would he like to do it? And so we thought, well, we'd probably rather that he didn't do that, not because just because we felt that we'd rather he... gets any ideas about religiosity or not from us.
Sure. So you're able to opt out from the religious education component.
Yeah, but it was In those days, there was no one school database as I have now, and nobody, I think all the kids, Jeremy, regardless of what the Education Act said, all of the kids got thrown into it until the parents protested, even if
that's right. At the time, it was sort of the default assumption that all kids would do it unless their parents were.
Even though it wasn't, but there was no way of telling who was what, because they didn't look at enrollment forms to see what was on it, which is how it's supposed to work. But honestly, yeah, it's been going since forever. It was from the Education Act of 1910. So
that dealt with the religious education component, but at some point it came to your attention there was something else going on in the schools as well.
It was, and that was okay, but it didn't take long, as happens to many parents, even at that stage, when two things would always happen. Kids that were doing it and your kid wasn't would come up to your child and say, you're going to go to hell because you don't do religious. They were calling it religious education, even though the Act was called religious instruction.
Right.
There are two different things, religious education and religious instruction, generally two decidedly different things. As I used to get involved in meetings at the schools where they'd protest that there was no difference, it was only semantics, I'd offer them to swap with sex education and religious instruction and say, could we call it religious? could we call it sex instruction?
And, okay, I see the point of the terminology.
They'd be killed in the rush with all the kids. The other one, they didn't sort of understand that there was a difference in the two words. It wasn't just semantics. But I am digressing. Anyway, so it was that little Andre was coming home from school saying that he was getting told to go to hell by other kids. But the other thing was, we found out he was doing it anyway because he was coming home singing all these little evangelical ditties. And I said, where'd you hear that? Oh, in religious education. But we're not supposed to be doing it. But and so we sort of said, well, can you keep him out of it? But he kept singing them because they're leaving him in the same room anyway.
Like, oh, okay.
The front couple of desks were doing it, but the kids at the back were the ones that weren't doing it. But
so they're in the same room. Okay, interesting. When did you first hear about the chaplain?
Well, this is how it came about. Andre had kind of got to about grade two, year two by this. And it came to our attention that there were going to be changes made in the religious, in the Education Act, so that children would be able to do other philosophies and other worldviews and stuff in religious instruction. So I was having a real battle keeping Andre out of it at this stage. I used to have to physically go and sit with him, read to him, read to him stories about the history of the world and stuff, as in 4.6 billion years or whatever. Anyway, that aside, we were following these changes to the Education Act quite closely, and it had come to my attention. It was getting a lot of exposure on various ABC radio programs and people for and against it. It was by the Beattie government were going to be doing this. A fairly progressive education minister at that stage, named Rod Welford, was doing it. And it was being instigated by a woman that was actually the president of the Queensland Humanist Association, but was also the representative for the Queensland Teachers Union on a body that looked after religious matters in the state schools,
okay,
on a board. So this woman had actually worked with Rod Welford in developing this part of the Education Act to finally change it since 1910. Anyway, unfortunately, on the last reading of it, Peter Beattie caved in and said, look, we'll leave that alone. And we had followed that with quite some interest. So around the same time, there had been chaplains in Queensland state schools since the 80s, early 80s.
Yep.
Chaplains were introduced to Queensland state schools without any money, funded by the community and the churches. And they literally still do get into the schools via the Education Act, even though they're not mentioned in it, to assist with religious instruction. And so they're quite controversial. There maybe would have been 150 or so in Queensland schools. And we knew about them, and because wherever they were doing 5 day a week religious instruction during school hours, even when religious instruction wasn't on. So wherever they were a bit controversial. But around the same time that thing happened to the Education Act, Peter Beattie, wanting to get some grounding in the Queensland state elections for Toowoomba North, Peter Beattie wanted to try and make sure that North Toowoomba was going to be secured. And he actually came out to Highfields and introduced a scheme. This was before John Howard, of the Queensland state government funding chaplains in state schools. Scripture Union Queensland had been given the job to provide them without money, had been given the contract, for want of a better name, by Kevin Rudd when he was chief of staff working for the Queensland government. So they had, Scripture Union had been doing it in the Queensland schools. Anyway, Peter Beattie introduced funding for the first time for chaplains in Queensland state schools. And almost hot on the heels of that, only a matter of weeks after, John Howard introduced
the national
NSCP. Yeah.
So, sorry to interrupt you there. So
that's right.
We get the chaplaincy gets a lot of attention, a lot of public attention. Where do you come in at the point of deciding this is wrong, somebody needs to do something about it, that someone is going to be me? How does that sort of thought process come around?
This is where it begins, because when I even knew that the changes to the religious instruction thing had been knocked on the head, I knew that that was being done by the Queensland Humanists, and I thought, well, they sound like they're fairly active in this sort of thing. If they could achieve that much, almost get it to a third reading. So I did join the Human Society of Queensland at that stage.
Okay.
That was in 2005, 6, whatever. And so I had been attending their meetings and keeping an eye on what was going on. And the school that I was at, and I won't mention it, it's not the one that has children right now, they had never had chaplains at all because they never wanted one.
Yep.
But as soon as the funding began, a whole lot of schools all of a sudden decided that they'd partake.
Sure, yeah.
Because the money was going to be there, even though the money didn't go to them, it was going to go to whatever body was employing the chaplains. And I'd always been an active member of the PNC, not to be a stirrer, just to go along and do, and as was Andrew, to go along and do group reading with kids and all that kind of things, and volunteering and making lamingtons, whatever it is.
Okay, no, so you're a good active parent in the...
But I saw the emergence at the PNC of it coming over the horizon, and all of a sudden at one PNC meeting, I said, we think we might be going to get a chaplain. We might be applying for a chaplain. What the? We've never had a chaplain. What are you all doing? Oh, because there's money there. And John Howard's dishing out money, so we might as well be in on it. And it didn't seem right that all of a sudden they hadn't had one before and they didn't really need one before, that just on the basis of that there would be one.
Right.
So in all of the lining up for that, there was no consultation done whatsoever, even though it's supposed to be. But it was in that I was seeing that the programs that the chaplain was going to be doing, including Hillsong programs like Shine for Girls and Strength for Boys. And even then, I'd done a bit of research and found that they were quite controversial. And so there was all kinds of stuff going on with them. So we weren't all that pleased about it. But at the same time, within the humanists, there was an academic, Dr. Max Wallace, he had written a book called The Purple Economy, all about money that goes into what he calls the supernatural charities. And so he was totally across all of this thing. And Max had pointed out a case to do with a man named Vecchio, who was upset about the federal government and state government funding in New South Wales for the World Youth Day for the Catholic Church.
Okay.
And the Commonwealth government had put quite a few, I think over $1 million into that, as had New South Wales government. Mm-hmm. And Vecchio, to cut a long story short, had tried to take it to the High Court. And it got thrown out once, and I think it got thrown out twice. And he managed to get it heard to the stage that it was going to get a listening to, but it ended up getting thrown out as being vexatious.
Oh, okay.
Going in on 116 on Establishment.
Right.
A heartbreaking track, that one. But
yeah.
Anyway, that was that it was, and I've got to thank Max. We're good friends, and we speak. I think Max is now the secretary of the Rationalist Society of New South Wales, and so Max is an active humanist member. I ended up being the president of the Humanist Society of Queensland, which I still am.
So Max's experience kind of gave you a bit of an idea or a model that litigation was a possibility.
I've got Max to thank, Jeremy, because there was a Max corresponded with what was to be my solicitor.
Okay.
Claude Belinsky, the wonderful Claude Belinsky. And so one day in my email box, there was an email that Max had corresponded by email with Claude Belinsky, mentioning Vecchio, because Claude was Vecchio's solicitor.
Okay.
And Max had said, no, there's this the Vecchio case. This is bloke wants to get involved with National School Chaplaincy Program. And Max had given Claude some preliminary details about it. Mm-hmm. I think I might be paraphrasing. I'm pretty sure it was that Claude said back to Max, totally lawyer talk here, Jeremy. I think Claude had said, I think this case has legs.
Okay. So that's really interesting. So it wasn't a situation where you had to sort of knock on doors and persuade a lawyer to take your case. You were already had somebody sort of gifted to you from Max's experience.
Absolutely.
Okay.
In that sliding doors theory of the what if, yeah, so many things fell into place with that email to Claude.
Okay.
And the one back. And so before long, I was having a long conversation with Claude. Mm-hmm. On the phone, talking about doing a briefing in Sydney. And Claude was a wonderful man. He said, you realise, Ronnie, he said, you know that if we lose, there's a lot of money involved.
Yeah, and actually that's one of the things I wanted to ask you about, because in Australia, unlike in America, when you bring a constitutional civil liberties sort of challenge, in Australia, if you lose, you don't only pay your own lawyer's fees, you can pay the defending side's, the government's lawyer fees. So there's a real risk to litigation in Australia, and that's one of the reasons we have so few constitutional challenges. So what was that like for you in contemplating whether to go through with it or not?
Yeah, well, Claude sort of said, well, look, and he is a wonderful bloke. I mean, Claude, he wasn't a lawyer that would want to take you to the cleaners no matter what happened. I think that worst to happen, Claude would have probably taken a bath on his own costs. Mm. But he said, look, if the worst happens, you know, you could end up having to declare bankruptcy.
Yeah, hundreds of thousands of dollars could be in a cost order. Yeah.
And I pointed out that the Williamses have never been rich people ever. And we've been such optimists that we declare death as a bit of a setback.
Okay.
I'm probably, I'm not saying that for all the other Williamses. I'm sure they didn't ever think like that. Anyway, with this Python-esque kind of optimism, I said, well, look, you know, he said, we need to talk to you about getting an opinion anyway of Gerald. He said, if we do this case, I would want this particular team, which he outlined. And so it was Brett Walker, of course, and Gerald Lung as the junior. And he said, they're the only people that we could approach for this. And so we lined up for me to go down to Sydney and have a briefing.
So you said you were optimistic initially. Did your optimism kind of continue throughout, or were you ever given a sort of, you have a 50% chance of winning or a 10% chance of winning? Did they kind of boil it down to that sort of situation? Or,
well, Jeremy, of course, we had to get this opinion, and that was going to cost. And here again, I wasn't the president of the humanists at that stage. I was a mere member, and I've got to hand it to them. I don't think I couldn't have proceeded to the, because as you know, opinions cost money.
Yes. Yep.
And so it wasn't a fortune, but it was a substantial number of thousands. And so they helped me out with that to be able to cover the cost of the opinion. Mm-hmm. And we wouldn't have progressed at all if the opinion hadn't been optimistic itself, not right. My opinion, its opinion.
Yep.
And so, they came up with the opinion and with words that I know now about reading down. And it was all there. And they felt that, I know we're going to come to 116 here. And we, as much as all of the people that were wanting me to do this case were wanting it to be done basically on establishment, not so much for the officer of the Commonwealth part of it. But everybody was always eager to try and look at establishment in anything where the Commonwealth government would be funding anything to do with religion, as you probably talked about before.
So I might just pause for a minute there. So for our listeners who aren't very familiar with the Constitution, we know that Section 116 contains a few different provisions related to religion. One guarantees freedom of religion. One says there shall be no establishment of religion. And then there's a provision about there shall be no religious oaths for officers of the Commonwealth. Mm-hmm. And so, without getting into Australian constitutional history, it's incredibly difficult for an Establishment Clause case to be launched. There's never been a successful one in the High Court in Australia. So the establishment angle, the advice you were given was that it's not likely to be successful. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's okay. Right. And then so all of the people and the other sort of constitutional academics that were in organizations that were sort of secular based, they're all putting in, as we call it, their two bobs worth.
Sure.
And no, you should be going in for establishment. There's the other one saying, oh, well, these people they're getting employed. You can probably, they can be maybe be questioned as being officers under the Commonwealth.
Right.
Under the religious test, as it says in that section, in section 116 and 116. And anyway, look, through all of the discussions with Claude and with the opinion, when the opinion came through, they said, look, you're not going to probably get anywhere with establishment.
Yeah.
It's always going to be about the right of the Commonwealth to fund this without legislation. It was always going to be that. Mm-hmm. The dogs kept yapping at my heels, Jeremy.
So, yes,
there's no chance about establishment. What about 1 month? What about the religious test? And look, Gerald, I hadn't got to speak to Brett at this stage. You don't get to speak to Brett at this stage. The mere plaintiff doesn't get that far.
Okay.
But not that he wouldn't speak to you, but he didn't. Anyway, Gerald had said, look, we will take it in with the officer under the Commonwealth. But they said, snowball in hell,
It wasn't likely. So
anyway, with 2020, even 40-40 hindsight, Jeremy, it shouldn't have even been in the writ. It shouldn't have even gone in there to the High Court because it was guaranteed to fail straight up.
I think you're probably right for most observers, knowing the High Court and its view on Section 116, that probably didn't have very likelihood, a very good chance of success. So the litigation ended up proceeding primarily on this issue of what may be a sort of arcane constitutional issue to some people about appropriations and financial powers of the executive without legislative support and all this sort of stuff about funding, basically, and when can the Commonwealth pay for something. How did you feel about the case proceeding on that ground? Were you happy because it was your best chance of winning, or were you disappointed it wouldn't be on an establishment clause sort of angle and establish a new principle?
No, Jeremy, I was happy enough with that because I knew that these people knew far more than I knew at that stage.
Okay.
And And even with my vague knowledge of reading through an opinion, I could see where they were going with it. And I could see that there were obviously many, many factors in there that they seemed to think that had good grounds for taking this case on.
Yep.
But here again, I had all those little chihuahuas snapping at my heels. And I was, oh, well, well. And these are organisations and people that had actually contributed to my being able to mount the case anyway.
Right.
So reluctantly, I said, well, look, we'll take that in. We'll put it in there. But I think I'll show you the opinion one day. In all of the opinion, it was a very lengthy document. And it occupied about one paragraph on the bottom of the opinion, the bit about the officers under the Commonwealth. And there are many dots to join up between the government through Scripture Union, through the employment, through the chaplains, through the here, through.
Yes.
It was probably never going to fly. And here again, it would have been better left out because, of course, when the decision came down on that fateful day with only one dissenter, which was Hayden, wasn't it? Justice Hayden dissented.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about that. So you bring the lawsuit, you're successful, the decision comes down. This funding for school chaplaincy is invalid. Mm. Maybe my first question is, what was it like going through that process just as an individual, as a parent in Toowoomba, which isn't a small town, but it's also in what's sometimes considered the sort of Bible Belt of Australia. It's a fairly conservative religious city. Did you face hostility? This case did get a lot of national media attention. What was it like for you as a person going through this?
I mostly faced hostility, Jeremy, in Toowoomba, but because the local newspaper was it has all kinds of their letters to the editor in our local paper is ferocious. Mm. And I think by then they even had probably the Facebook thing on, which is. It itself could be a source of much litigation for defamation, I'm sure. In
sure, sure.
But it was fiercely hostile here. But although there were plenty of people on my side in the town, but in a town of this size, the hostility shows through much more than your support. But on a national basis, no, I had magnificent support from mums and dads. And
oh, okay, yeah.
We did have a fund that the solicitors opened up that people could donate to by banking into. It was totally for the case. I couldn't, it wasn't for me.
Yeah.
Cost and disbursements. And look, it raised, something like $150,000, $200,000, mostly from people out there.
Just the support, yeah.
It was an enormous amount of support. So I can't complain about that.
And we should, I guess, clarify. So the reason you had standing to bring the suit to begin with is because you were a parent of a child enrolled in a school that had a chaplain.
That's right.
What was it like being, because you said you were a very active member of the school's, you know, parent committee. What was that like being involved in a school that you're suing, basically? Did you get pushback or were people fairly kind about it? What was that like?
Well, by the time, and you're aware of the school that we're at, that was the epicenter of both cases.
Yep.
I had it's the current principal is still there, but this was the one at the time. And we had very good rapport, Jeremy. He didn't feel that I was victimizing the school. He did.
Oh, that's good, okay.
I had to have standing somewhere.
Yeah.
I even had good rapport with the woman that was the chaplain at the time. I mean, even though our children weren't involved in the chaplaincy,
yeah,
she understood that it wasn't ending personal either. So,
oh, okay, that's good to hear.
There were good vibes all around there, as far as that went.
But, so the decision comes down, you've won. What did you think then? Did you think that's the end? I can kind of sail off into sunset. Did you know that there's just going to be another round going on? What how did you, I guess, react to that?
Well, I have to tell you this part, Jeremy, because right up until that decision, because as you know, there are various other cases. There are hearings I had to go to in Sydney leading up to the cases at the Sydney High Court, directions hearings and things like that. So I'd go down through every one of those. And throughout all of them, there's always media interest from the very first one. And every one, I was really glad because it made more people be aware of the case that could help me. Sure. But, you know, so obviously by the time the decision came down, I went to Sydney for the decision. And by this, like 7:30 on ABC had been following it. And they actually had a camera in Claude's office to hear the decision coming down with me and Claude sitting at the desk.
Oh, really? I didn't know that.
7:30 on that night. And if it had come down in flames, it was going to be on national TV.
Wow, okay, I didn't know that. That's interesting. Yeah.
And so they'd been doing prep for this thing, and they'd been getting footage of me singing jazz and stuff and with the big band. It was all ready for this culmination of it was going to be this thing for 7:30 on the night, and other associated programs were all poised. And so I sat there in Claude's office, and the decision came down, and he said, we've won. I think I said, good grief. It's a fairly ecclesiastical thing to say, wasn't it?
Good sure. Grief.
Anyway, and so that was great. I thought, wow. And so that's all right. And so the second after it, I was in Sydney for it, as I said, and I had to get back. And within an hour of it happening, I was getting all of these phone calls from radio stations all over Australia. And suddenly I was expecting congratulations, Jeremy, and I hadn't even seen the 7:30 thing yet. And I was all of these people, that some of them I'd spoken to before, they'd suddenly become shock jocks overnight.
Oh, okay.
I didn't see this coming. And they're saying, what have you done? They said, first of all, you've lost the case. I said, what are you talking about? They said, you've lost the case on religious freedom. I said, no. Yeah, well, oh, yeah, how about that? No. See, the chaplains have got right now to be in the schools, and it's great, you know. They didn't worry about the officers under the Commonwealth. All they heard was, and of course, the ACL, the Christian Lobby, sort of hit the airwaves before me. He's like, we won, the little bugger. And I'm saying, no. But then it got worse, Jeremy. They're saying, but also, what have you done? All of these programs now aren't going to be able to go ahead because of you, because of what you've done.
Okay, yes.
Things including the roads program isn't going to be able to go ahead. And I'm like, no. And they were being abusive to him. I thought, no. And by the time I was still taking calls, I'm going to get as far as Coolangatta Airport, and I'm coming home in the car, and I'm getting calls from ABC people that before that were kind of fairly friendly to me. They're saying, you've ruined everything. All of these programs are not going to be able to go ahead. And by the time Jeremy had got to my 7:30 thing, it looked good for the start. They showed me and Claude, you've won, blah, blah, blah. I've got it. I'll send you the clip sometime. But then it degenerated. They had a man like in a high-vis thing with all work behind him saying he's going to stop the funding happening for roads for recovery program or something for the Commonwealth government. And this man literally said, there are going to be deaths.
Oh, wow, okay.
manslaughter out of this before.
So just to provide a little bit of context, if the listeners aren't aware, so when the High Court issues its decision, the reason that the school chaplaincy funding is invalidated is it was purely done by the executive government, and there's no statute saying the executive government can spend this money. And so that then, in theory, puts at risk something like 200 other government spending programs that also don't have legislative support. And that's where you get this idea that the Roads for Recovery program, or whatever it is the next one that's going to be struck down. So we know what the Commonwealth does in response. It passes this very strange sort of statute that purports to give legislative support for school chaplaincy. And that then strikes off another round of litigation. And can you tell me a little bit about going through this all a second time?
Well, that's right, Jeremy. And so then, because my decision came, I think, only about a week before there was a lot of money that had to be paid for a tranche of the chaplain's next wave of payments. Mm-hmm. Of course, every time this happens, all of these years of the payments that were now declared invalid, they didn't sort of say, well, you've got to pay it back.
That's right. That's true. Yeah.
It's money down the gurgler. So, but there was money to be paid. And this was under the Labor government. So there was this media press conference came out and they said, oh, no, we're going to fix it. It's got to be cured, I think was the word that they used. We're going to sort this out. And as you know, they instantly brought in some other, I think somebody called it fig leaf legislation. But it was like, yep, a band-aid that they put on it so that they could indeed do this.
Yeah, it was essentially a sort of any program that's not supported by legislation is hereby now supported by legislation. That was a sort of a catch-all omnibus mechanism to try and...
actual framework, something. Yeah. Yeah. If you, even the acronym was about 5 sentences long. Yeah. And so that got the money through, you see, so that was okay.
Yeah.
And I got a call, because all this happened in rapid succession. So then I got a call from Claude. He said, Ronnie, because we're awarded costs. And here again, with 60-60 hindsight, they should have started trying to get their costs back then. But Claude said, we can go back in. And I could show you in this very house where I was standing. And Andrea wasn't too far away. And she must have seen the look on my face. Anyway, I said, oh. Anyway, they did subsequent phone calls that was explained that this thing was just so shaky. Even George Brandis,
yes,
who then was the Attorney General, I think, of the Shadow Attorney General.
Shadow Attorney General, yes.
He said, this is ridiculous.
Yeah, it was, I can testify, widespread in the legal and academic community that this attempt to fix it was not likely to be successful if it were challenged.
A bridge fell down and they put like a flying fox across.
Something like that, yeah. A band-aid to salvage a
and
a
so everybody pillar. Said, this can't last. And so here we go again. So then the whole thing started again with the rich and the...
Yep.
Yeah. And the direction hearings and the whole thing started. Way we went.
And so you go through this again. It takes a couple years. You again get a victory. You've won twice in the High Court. And then the second time, though, we know the Commonwealth decides, okay, we're not going to be able to do this through direct spending, through the executive. We're not going to be able to do this through legislation because we don't have a head of power in the Constitution. It's called over chaplaincy. So what we're going to do is use the Section 96 grants mechanism, give money to the states on the condition that they give money to chaplaincy service providers to hire chaplains for schools. Exactly. So it's a roundabout sort of way to do it, but it seems like it's hard to challenge that. So looking, I guess, back on it, what are your thoughts on that? Did you know that they would find a way somehow or another to do it? Were you surprised that they relied on grants? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, Jeremy, everybody that knew said that just give them whatever time it would take, from 3 hours to 3 months, that sooner or later they will put this thing out to the states.
Yeah.
And as you do know, and at your wonderful colloquium that you had before my first decision, mm-hmm, at USQ, Ann Toomey, Professor Ann Toomey, attended and I think delivered a paper, I think, at that.
Yes.
And in her, when she delivered that, she's a wonderful person, Ann Toomey. We have corresponded ever since, but when she spoke, she said that there will be Williams 1, because Williams 1 hadn't been decided yet. She said, but then there'll be Williams 2. She said, she said, maybe Williams 3. But at the end of it all, she said, they'll probably just give it to the states.
Yeah.
Even then, and so many people said it. So it was gut-wrenchingly disappointing on that fateful day. I saw on the press release that was going to happen. They did put it aside for about 3 or 4 months, I think, while they were figuring out what they'd do towards the end of that year, because it was around budget time here again when that decision came down. Here again, more payments, and so there was one due in a couple of days that had just been given. And I think who was the treasurer then was the man that's flying around now at government expense trying to get his place on the OECD or whatever.
Oh, okay. I'm not familiar with that.
It was him that he'd said, well, look, it's too late now. They can keep the money that was just given them or about to give them, whatever. And it sat aside for a couple of months, but it kept going. It kept going under the funding that they'd already had. And it wasn't before too long, they just said, look, well, it's going to come out again and go through the states. But of course, what happened, Jeremy, it had been getting run with government guidelines and stuff, even though there was no legislation. So they really probably weren't worth the paper that they're written on, but they were guidelines as such. But of course, when it got handed out to the states, it just was given up by a watery little agreement that says in the fine print, this has no legal binding, this piece of paper, and it doesn't really say anything. And so as it is run under the states now, it's quite it's a rudderless ship. But when it happened, I realized then that there's no more that can be done
Yes.
via litigation or via through the Commonwealth, whatever.
So that second High Court decision was handed down, I think, in 2014. So you've had 5 or 6 years, I guess, to think about it. Are you proud of the legacy of the course, the cases, and sort of the principles that you establish, or are you more sort of depressed that you spent that time in going through it, and school chaplaincy is still around? How do you feel, sort of, with the benefit of hindsight? Is it something you would do again?
I probably would have something that could be done, but there's nothing can be done. So it's disappointing. I'm probably not depressed about it. The only unfortunate thing is that since it's gone out to the States, it's kind of gone totally underground. There's really no complaints process whatsoever. And every state handles it as individual as human fingerprints on a person. So it's done in different ways in every state. And 90% of the stuff that goes on is under the radar. And it's really probably the most depressing part is that when it came to the crunch in the last time it got really reinstated in 2000 and time flies having fun, where are we? 2020, 2016, it was granted permanent status, as they called it, under the Morrison government at that stage. And so what's happening is now every year it gets awarded another $64 million, or inflation weighted up a bit, maybe. That doesn't go for next year. That goes on to the end of the funding. So now it's extended through until 2024.
So unless there's a big political change at the top, this funding is likely to continue into perpetuity, probably.
Well, that would be a third party, major party, because Labor would never touch it, and neither would the LNP.
Well, I really appreciate you speaking with me today. I use your cases as an example when I teach constitutional law to my students of how someone can win twice in the High Court but still not achieve their desired results because the Commonwealth just has so many mechanisms to achieve its goals. And I think that's maybe really what your experience is a good example of the Commonwealth's power under the High Court interpretation to achieve what it wants to do.
Yeah, and to round it off, Jeremy, what you're saying. But look, I'm happy to have done both cases, and it was probably the most exciting thing that's ever happened in my life.
Oh, okay. Well,
Apart
I'm
from
happy to hear you have some good memories of it as well,
and I met a lot of wonderful people throughout, and I'm still in communication with them always, in all kinds of things, in the legal field, and just mums and dads And every year is another year that my kids will probably not even be in schools anymore.
That's a good point. Okay. Well, thank you again for speaking with me today. I really appreciate it. It was a really good conversation.
It's a pleasure, Jeremy.
If you're listening and have questions or comments about the episode, please email me at jeremy.patrick@usq.edu.au. I may feature listener comments in a segment on a future episode. And if you enjoyed the episode and want to listen to something else in a similar vein, I'd like to recommend the Legal Spirits podcast from the St. John's Law School Center for Law and Religion, which focuses on American Supreme Court issues. It was one of the inspirations for this podcast. I'll be back in 2 months with another episode of Law and Religion Down Under. Until then, I'm Jeremy Patrick, and thanks for listening.